Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. Before we get started today, I have a favor to ask our listeners. Caroline is turning 85 on June 8th, 2020. And if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that Caroline loves sending and receiving mail. So we would like to ask you to send a birthday card. We're making it a surprise, so send it to Caroline Kilborn, care of Monica Hadley, P.O. Box 337, Fairfield, Iowa, 52556. That's P.O. Box 337, Fairfield, Iowa, 52556. Thank you, and now on with the show. Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. And once again, I am your host, Monica Hadley. And once again, my co-host is my darling mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you for that. Yeah, and it's a beautiful day in Iowa. I hope it is wherever you are, listeners. It really is. So we are, we have today an interesting book. It's, the author is, though the book is first The Laundress, and the author is Barbara Sapienza, PhD. Is a retired clinical psychologist and alumna of San Francisco State University's Creative Writing Master's Program. She writes and paints. I'd like to see that. And nourished by her spiritual practices of meditation, Tai Chi, and dance. Her family, friends, and grandchildren are her teachers. That's lovely. Her first novel, Anchor Out, received an IPPY Bronze Medal for Best Regional Fiction West Coast. She lives in Sausalito, California, with her husband. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Barbara.
Thank you so much, Caroline. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, this book is very interesting. You know, I didn't know, I was just looking at the title, I thought, now what's that going to be about? Well, I found out.
Oh, thank you.
So is this your second published novel then?
Yes, this is the second one. I published one 3 years ago in April called Anchor Out. And this is the next one. And yeah.
And are they at all similar, or are they completely different?
Well, I think they're very different. Anchor Out is about a lady who lives out on the water. She's 60 years old and in a former nun, and she's kind of finding refuge and trying to find redemption. So in some ways, the new novel is similar in that there's a search going on for, you know, finding your inner home and that sort of thing. But they have very different ages and life wisdoms and that sort of thing. One lives in a boat and one doesn't. They're a little different.
Have you ever lived on a boat?
I've never lived on a boat, but I live in Sausalito, and there's a little Indian cafe that I've gone to for years, and a lot of the people come in from their boats, and sometimes they've had horrendous nights on the sea, storms. You know, they live anchored out, which means they row a little boat to their boat that they sleep on, and they would tell all these stories, and I thought, these people are so brave, you know. I mean, on a nice day, you think, oh, my God, this is great. But when there's a storm at sea, it's So I got very interested in them.
Wow.
And my character just wanted to live in a boat, unlike me. I like the firm ground.
Well, you know, I never thought about trying to live on a boat, except there's this yacht that you can buy a condo on, this gigantic yacht, and the condo association decides where it's going to sail to, and so it sails all around the world all the time, and you can get on and off, you know, wherever you want. And that to me sounded like it could be a lot of fun, but you have to be
very exciting and very expensive. Right.
But wouldn't that be a great way to see the world?
Yes. I had a niece who, one of her college years, a junior year, she spent on a boat, and she went everywhere. She went to Vietnam, she went to India, and she just sailed, and the teachers were on board, and, you know, medical people were on board, and she said it was the most incredible experience she's ever had, you know.
Was it like a whole
semester on board?
Yeah, I think it was a whole semester rather than a year.
Oh,
Yeah.
That would be so awesome.
So you tell your grandkids and your kids those things. Well, of course, now with the coronavirus, we probably don't want to go on a boat.
I know. That is the other thing. I don't think I'll ever get – neither of my kids ever wanted to go on a cruise ever. And I was trying to convince my son maybe over Christmas this year that a Disney cruise would be so cool, you know, with the grandkids. And he's like, no. No, we're not doing that. I'm not getting on a cruise boat. And he was right.
He was right. Not in the days of cholera, you know, love in the days of cholera. They're on this boat going back and forth, you know.
Wow. So the laundress, you have a young woman of Italian descent who has lived in San Francisco since she was 4 years old and kind of finds herself adrift. So she may not be on a boat,
there she
but
is.
She's
adrift. On a boat.
A boat of her own making. A boat of her own making.
How did this character come to life? Lavinia. Where did you find her?
Well, you know, I was in a class and the teacher was saying, okay, write about a character and give the character some quirks. So I thought of this young girl who chewed gum, who twisted her hair, who said, you know, who was about 25. And I thought, and her name was Lavinia. And I had a friend. I do have a friend. Her name is Serena. She's giving me permission to use her name. And I said, how did you get that name, Serena? And she said, well, she was born in Italy, and it was a custom among some Italians in the South to name, if they had a pretty last name, they would just give the first name. So I thought, oh, my gosh. So I called her Lavinia. And I didn't really know much more about her except that she liked to drink coffee. She liked to chew gum. She lived in San Francisco, and she had a friend who was an older man who's the Jack Luce character, who's kind of becomes he's sort of into time and clocks. And I wanted her to be looking at time because I think time is so fascinating. So that's how I started with those two characters.
I was wondering now, tell me this, are there really people who have that profession as laundresses? Are there really people that do that?
I don't know if they do that anymore. I know it's kind of like in the novel, the barista asks her, well, laundress, that's kind of old Victorian or something. So I don't know. I don't know if anybody calls themselves a laundress. I think maybe in movies or where there are laundresses, but she's actually does laundry.
For a very high rate of pay.
That's right. She does. That's probably a good sign for her because she's very self-degrading in a certain way. But I think it's because it's San Francisco, and San Francisco is really impossible to pay rent and to, you know, to buy a house or rent. There's just so much competition with the tech. Technology that's in the south of San Francisco, so I think that could be a going rate for 4 hours.
Boy, well, I just wondered because, well, you know, there are probably people that are so busy with their business that they don't have time to do their laundry. I'll bet there are. There are probably some people that do it.
That's true. And if you own clothing that costs $500-$600 per item, paying $200 a week to have it taken care of, isn't that extreme?
I guess so. I mean, I always did my own laundry. My mother always did her own laundry. My grandmother did her own laundry. So I thought, well, you know how they always say, write what you know about? Mm-hmm. And I thought, when I was writing the novel, as I sat down to begin, I said, well, Barbara, what do you know about? And I know about a lot of things, but I really know about laundry. And that's what I picked, you know. I could have picked something else, right?
Yeah.
How funny.
Well, doing laundry is almost a spiritual practice for Lavinia. Is it that way for you?
Well, I find it very healing in a certain way. It's kind of like you put the clothes in, and then you take them out, and they're refreshed. there's a kind of purification that happens. And when you take care of your clothes, you're showing them a certain kind of love, and you're not taking them for granted. And I do find it as a spiritual thing for myself. You know, it's like if you go on a trip and you wash your underwear by hand, you never do that at home. You just kind of throw it in the hamper. But it's kind of an act of renewal. You know, it's like, I'm going to refresh in these things, and the next day it'll be refreshed. It'll be like a new sunrise. And I do think of it that way. And I think I had tried to show that she thought of it in that way as well.
Well, she certainly took pride and in her work, and did the very, I thought, did the very best she could for each of her customers,
uh-huh.
Or her clients. And but I'll bet you there's laundresses today. I'll bet there are.
Yeah. I think they probably, I don't know if they call themselves the laundress in this country, but maybe in England or somewhere. I don't know for sure.
Well, I know that there are certainly, you can send your laundry out to be done. And
right.
People certainly do that. Now, Lavinia is a little different in that she comes into the home to do laundry.
Right, right. And I guess I had her do that because she's really searching. It's kind of like an odyssey, you know. In my mind, the whole story is like a matrix for finding home, kind of like Homer's Odyssey, that she's actually trying to find home. And I think when she goes into other people's homes, I put her to do that so she could see, how do other people live, and are there families, and you know, she just wanted to kind of get into the life of other people, and that was part of her journey, I think, to finding her home place. And so that was the reason I thought about putting her I didn't really think about it, actually, Monica and Carolyn. I just had her go into people's homes. But now that I think about it, I think, yeah, she's searching for something, you know.
Yeah, of course, for the most part, she had a bunch of weirdos that she went into their homes. But
yeah, really, didn't she?
Yeah, she did, really.
And they were really weird, too.
Mm-hmm. Who was it that was recommending her to these people?
It was her dentist, and I think in my mind her dentist was when her uncle Scott left her to go back to Naples. He put her in connection with the dentist who she had worked for, and he was the one who was giving her referrals. So I think those referrals came through Sal's asking him to, you know, watch out for Lavinia. So all the referrals came through him. They might have been his clients, or I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, I know the people that her clients had referred to this person and seemed to be very sure that he knew what he was doing, so they were confident that she would be okay, you know. So
Yes.
Okay, good.
Except for there was one guy there that was really kind of troubled, very troubled, and
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Barbara Sapienza, author of The Laundress. So you started out with this character in response to a writing assignment. At what point did you think you had a novel for her?
Yeah, well, I just started writing then, and I wrote every day, and eventually, you know, she wanted to be in certain places, and just like that woman who wanted to live on a boat, I handwrite my novels, and I just find that the character will just tell me what they want and what they need and who they are, and so I kind of follow that. And I was just following her through North Beach and then into the Mission District of San Francisco and back and forth and up and down the hills. And pretty soon this story emerged. And I didn't really know what the story was. And recently, like about I would say within the last 3 months, I thought about my grandmother. My grandmother was born in like 1896, and she came to not to California, but to Boston as a little girl at 4 years old. And I didn't know when I was writing this story that maybe I was trying to understand my grandmother coming here to the California, no, I keep saying I wish she were in California, to Boston. And then her father left her and her mother and her sister and went back and never came home. So she was a little girl at four. I didn't really ever talk too much to her about this, but I think in the psyche, it was wanting to come out in some way. And Lavinia was that little girl. And it just gives me chills because I never, you know, I think we, as writers, we're it's very subjective and we're working on something. That's how I feel about it for me anyway. And I think I was looking at her story in a certain way.
I'll bet you were. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, she came at four and her mother was left with the two daughters. They worked in a factory in Boston and life wasn't easy for her. And I just, and she was my most, she gave me such unconditional love, and I think somehow she was had to be in my story somewhere. And that's when I let myself write every day. I'm writing about an Italian girl, who's kind of looking for her parents, and so it's so funny.
So you say that you just start writing by hand, and
yes.
Do you end up then with that you have to cut a lot after the story emerges, or how do you then rearrange things to make the story work?
Yeah, that takes a few years then. Like the writing I do fast, and then the cutting, and there are lots of parts that I leave out, and then the parts that I keep in, I need to maybe do research and, and like you said, move it around and, yeah, so that, but I do get the story out. Often the ending is not the same. When I rewrite it, sometimes in both these books that anchor out in this one, the ending is slightly different than what I wrote. So I change those endings. After I'm rewriting and pulling threads and seeing where this is going, I want a different ending. So that's always a surprise to me.
Oh, interesting, interesting. Have you always wanted to be a writer?
No, I haven't. What I can say about writing is that my favorite class in school was penmanship, and I loved to write. I loved to watch the letters form. They were kind of magical. But I never wrote anything. I wrote my dissertation when I was in graduate school for psychology, and that was the closest I ever got to a big piece of work. And it was after I finished graduate school in the 90s that I decided I wrote my first novel, which hasn't been published. And then I kept writing. I've written about 5 novels. And I just love to write. It just came late. And my first novel was published 3 years ago when I was 72. So it just is a very late kind of thing for me. I said to my husband, I hope I have some time left because I have a lot to say.
You got to write fast here.
Right.
I was thinking the way she wrote this, that she was much younger than that. I mean, it just seemed like she was, because she was writing from a younger person's point of view. And I thought, so that's wonderful. That's really that
oh,
you can do that. That's wonderful.
Yeah, well, I have grandkids, and they're younger than that. They're 18, but yeah, I must have tapped into something. Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you felt that way, Caroline.
Yeah, I'm surprised too.
Yeah.
Well, Barbara, why don't you read a little bit from The Laundress for us?
Okay, do you have a favorite part you'd like me to read, or should I just read the first few pages in the beginning?
Probably the beginning is good, gives us a good flavor.
Okay, good. In chapter 1 of The Laundress, The Rings of Time. Lavinia walks toward Columbus Avenue in San Francisco from the Mission District, wearing her work uniform, black straight-leg jeans, a men's tuxedo jacket, and her T-strap shoes. She carries extra bubble gum in one pocket, and in another a few tiny fig leaves she harvested from a backyard tree. Monday mornings bring a lazy feeling on the street, if people aren't late for work, that is, and she isn't yet. As she nears Columbus, she sees cars looking for parking spaces and people milling around doorways, chatting, espressos in hand. The scent of roasted coffee beans floats into the street from the small cafes, intoxicating and tantalizing. Lavinia pops a piece of bubble gum into her mouth and lets the sugar pool into a liquid puddle on her tongue before she begins to chew. The first bite quells the unease she feels as she walks further and further away from her studio in the Mission and toward her new client's home. Jack Luth called only this morning, saying that since his wife died, his clothes have suffered. Now, only 30 minutes later, she is en route to his house in North Beach to discuss his laundry needs. Anticipation for the first meeting has brought fear and trembling into her body. A nervousness about entering an unknown house makes her ears ring. And as she recalls his soft, whispering voice, telling her that his wife died, a flutter enters her heart. The way his voice caught, the palpability of his sadness, both touched and scared her. Lavinia turns her focus to laundry. She loves to wash clothes. It is only while washing and ironing and folding that she feels fresh and clean and even unique. She feels blessed by her particular skills. She is a laundress. She enjoys ironing, sorting, and removing stains in people's homes, their own private sanctuaries. She likes getting an intimate look at other spaces. But in the first encounter at the door, when time seems to stand still, she always feels afraid. She's not sure what to say or do or who will greet her. Once inside, though, she is in awe of these places where people live so fully. Unlike her in her storefront studio, which is minimally embellished, empty of her personal touch. With its long, narrow front room, her space is like a barn, more suitable for a horse than a young woman. She decides to stop for coffee at Cafe Falcone in the 10 minutes she has before meeting Mr. Luce. The coffee aromas answer her misgivings and pull her inside the cafe, where she joins 6 people waiting to order. The wooden tables scattered about seem to say, "Sit down here and sip your latte." She orders a double espresso and stands at the bar instead to drink it, the way they do in Italy. The espresso slides down easily. She pays the barista, a young, good-looking guy, and places a piece of bubble gum in the tip jar before leaving to find the small street off Columbus where Mr. Luce lives. She's in the habit of tipping with bubble gum. It's something she started doing when she was in first grade. It endeared her to her classmates, and now it, along with the fig leaves, has become her signature. The good-looking guy's eyes seem to pop as they follow her hand to and from the tip jar. She can feel him still watching as she strolls back out onto Columbus. The neighborhood is a revival in Lavinia's eyes. North Beach's Italian bakeries, cafes, and delis interlace with Chinese restaurants, butcher shops, and outdoor markets. Every other place on the block is a patchwork of color, vibrant and seductive. Although Mr. Luce's place is near the cafe, its location on a small cul-de-sac brings it a sense of privacy as a neighborhood home. Lavinia enters the vestibule, presses the white buzzer next to Mr. Luce's name, then grasps a piece of her silky hair in her fingers of her right hand and begins to twirl into a tight twist as she waits.
He buzzes her in just as she snaps the bubble with her tongue. She opens the door to the inner foyer where mailboxes, a wooden table, line the wall. The entryway is carpeted in beige wool. Her feet press into luxurious carpet, soft and spongy under her feet, a welcome contrast to the cement sidewalk outside. The carpet has a few mean stains that make her wonder who spilled or dribbled. Was it a kid? Lovers playing? An old lady with trembling hands? She immediately focused on what she would do to remove them should she get the job. The aroma of dried lavender permeates the entryway. He told her on the phone to come up one flight and his door would be on the right. She notices an elevator on the left side of the hallway. Old-fashioned, small, but she takes the stairs as instructed. At the top of the stairway, she knocks on the door mark number 2 and waits with her ear to the wooden door. Footsteps approach, and she jumps back a little. When the door opens, an elderly gentleman stands before her. He's tall, thin, with white wispy hair and glasses with dark frames. She notices the crease in his pressed slacks and the starched collar of an otherwise soft blue cotton shirt. She imagines pressing his long sleeves, smelling the clean cotton thread. Mr. Luce says hello and smiles at her, ushers her inside his flat. His apartment is an Edwardian, once a large home, now subdivided into condominiums. Creamy white gives a light feel. The decor is soft and clean, splattered with fabrics too flowery for her taste. Assorted family photographs adorn the furniture. On a side table sits a bouquet of fresh yellow roses. On a mahogany dining table, set in a small alcove by the window, rests a starched blue linen tablecloth. Beautifully ironed, she feels her body relax. "Please, sit down," he points to one of the dining room chairs. His voice soft, as it was on the phone, puts her at ease. "Thank you, Mr. Luce. Oh, please, call me Zach. This work relationship won't be a formal thing, you know. I just want someone to help me keep up with my laundry. I used to do it myself, but since Elsa died, I'm not up to it anymore. I think I did it for her." Lavinia lowers her head at hearing his wife's name. It brings death too close for her comfort. The fact that this house has seen death scares her. She touches the smooth skin of the fig leaf in her pocket. "What exactly do you need?" she eyes his cotton pants, his long-sleeved shirt. "I like my bed sheets washed every week, and then there's kitchen linens and tablecloth and napkins." He looks toward the blue-covered table. Thinking how strange it is to keep up with this business of linens with his wife dead, Lavinia says instead, "Nice flowers."
Okay, that's a good place to stop.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That was Barbara Sapienza reading from The Laundress. Fig leaves. The fig leaf.
Yeah, fig leaf. That's curious.
There's a fig leaf on the cover of the book, and they show up throughout the book. What's the significance of fig leaves for you?
Well, for me, they're the tree of the gods. They give these most beautiful little fruits that can be sweet and round and soft, and they're very special as a food to eat, and they're very special as an ancient tree, and I wanted to combine that. And I know in Italy, figs are really a big thing, you know, they import them, but I think mostly it's a symbol. It's a symbol of antiquity or something.
Much of the book is kind of the setting, the neighborhood, is an important part of the book. And this is in San Francisco, North Beach, and what other neighborhood?
The Mexican District. It's called the Mission District.
The Mission District. So how have you lived there, or how much have you spent a lot of time in those neighborhoods?
Well, I spend a lot of time eating delicious burritos and tacos in the Mission District. And I lived in San Francisco from 1969 until 94. So I know San Francisco pretty well. I didn't live in North Beach, though, but that's another place where San Franciscans go. They go to eat in North Beach Italian food. They go to eat in the Mission District Mexican food. And they're very vibrant neighborhoods. So I decided, or she decided, that she was going to live in both those neighborhoods.
And those neighborhoods must have changed a lot since 1994. So what was your research like to get it into the modern day?
Well, you know, I'm always in San Francisco. I take classes. I know I took writing classes there. I take painting classes there. Many of my friends are there. So I would say before the coronavirus, where we're all sort of staying put, I was in San Francisco maybe 4 or 5 times a week. It's very close to where I live. It's just over the Golden Gate Bridge. And, you know, so I'm there all the time. And my art class was in the north, near North Beach. And I have friends who live in different parts. So, yeah, my research was mostly because I've been around there a lot.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Those were the exact two questions I was going to ask, Monica.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Great minds think alike. It seems like Lavinia is a bit, she becomes very introspective during the novel, but it seems like there's a lot that she never really thought about before. So what is the trigger for her becoming so introspective and really trying to figure these things out when she kind of ignored it previously?
That's a great question. I think what happened is she was on a good course when Uncle Sal lived in San Francisco. And when he left her before she was going to graduate from school, she kind of had a regression, I think, and she remembered that he never, I mean, everything was a secret from Sal. He never told her about her mother. She didn't know about her father. She didn't know her grandparents, who were Sal's mother and father. And when he left, she became very depressed and angry. And she remembered that something was missing in her life. And she started to have these dreams about her mother. And about the laundry, her mother doing laundry, hanging laundry out the window and calling her in a beautiful voice. And she remembered that she had had this opportunity to ask Sal, tell me about my mother, tell me about my mother. And he would cry. And he would cry because there was some terrible secret that happened, but she didn't know what it was. So I think after he left, to answer your question, after he left, she just was traumatized. And then she began her search. And her search took her to the laundry, and it took her to her best friend, whose mother catered to her and loved her, and it took her to the barista, and it took her where she needed to go. Yeah.
And she realizes that she knew absolutely nothing about her father.
Nothing.
And so she is determined to learn more about him. She at least knew who her mother was, but she didn't even know that about her father.
Right, and she didn't really, she just knew that her mother, she had these memories that her mother was Sal's sister, and he took her away from there, and maybe she disappeared. I mean, I don't think she really knows that she was dead in a certain way.
Oh,
until
wow.
Until her friend Kinky says, well, it sounds like she went to the angels, she died. You know, it's sort of like she was stuck in a, you know, sometimes when we have psychological trauma, we get stuck in a certain place and we really can't come out of it. And it causes a lot of averse reactions. And so I think I was trying to show that even though she was doing her thing, going to college, becoming a teacher,
that these things had an effect on her, and until she could unravel them, she couldn't be a full human being.
Now, Barbara, mm-hmm. you were a clinical psychologist, so I'm guessing that that background comes into play a little bit in how your characters develop.
Yes, I probably, it influences the way I think about people. Like, you know, Frances in my other novel is a bag lady. But what is a bag lady? You know, this woman was a nun. She was this, she was that. And so there's such a complex, we're so complex as human beings. And I think I think of that, that there's just the face, but behind the face are all these beautiful threads that contribute to what we see. So I think when I write, I'm always thinking about that. Like, oh, okay, so where did she come from? What was her life like? And yeah, it very much influences who I am.
Right.
And you know, people from different backgrounds look at the same situation, go through the same things, and yet they take different things away from it because of their backgrounds.
Exactly.
And,
Yeah.
Now, Barbara, your bio says that you practice meditation, Tai Chi, and dance, and I'm here in Fairfield, Iowa, and one of the radio stations that Writers' Voices broadcasts on is KHOE in Fairfield, Iowa, and the other one is KICI in Iowa City, and then we're also online on iTunes and so forth. But as you may know, Fairfield is the center of the Transcendental Meditation movement in Fairfield. So a lot of the listeners here are also practitioners of meditation.
Beautiful.
And how does that influence your writing?
Well, it has to do with being present. I yearn to be present in my life and not to miss it. And I think when I write, it helps me to get there. It's like when I meditate, it helps me to be present and to have awareness that when I'm rushing through, I don't really have. It's very grounding, and it opens my heart too. And so I think writing is a practice for me. It's like a meditation practice.
And dance.
Dance is the same. There's a group here. I don't know if you know this. There was a woman, and her name was Gabrielle Ross, and she's now dead, but she developed this thing called Five Rhythms, and she worked with Fritz Perls in that movement, and he invited her to teach the people who were in his workshops, the five rhythms. And the five rhythms, it's kind of like a meditation. It starts with flowing, which is very gentle. And then it goes to staccato, which is, you know, this really kind of strong beat, like a tapping beat. And then it goes to chaos. And after chaos, it comes back to lyrical, which is like a waltz. And then it comes to stillness. So through these five rhythms, you're actually stilling yourself in a certain way and really being on top of your beat, really listening to the beat, feeling the beat. And it is also a kind of meditation. So I think these three things are very related, and they're probably similar to the transcendental meditation, which I think I'm not sure exactly because I've never practiced it, but it must give a sense of that groundedness.
Yes, yeah. And there are groups here that do some kind of dancing as a meditative practice. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, I try to. Yeah, exactly. That's how it is. And so you're really with yourself, but you see how you are with others, how you are tuned to them or pull away, or, you know, how you become in the same rhythm at some times, and sometimes you see how disjointed you are from that person. And so it teaches you about yourself in space as well.
And your description of these dance sessions that Lavinia goes to with her new boyfriend are, I think they're really very, really convey the feel of it.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I try to incorporate that without, you know, giving names and stuff of people or anything. But, yeah, that's the dance. That's the dance that I do.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really very refreshing, you know. And I never was a dancer, just like I wasn't a writer. So these things came late to me. And they're just such gifts, you know.
Now, it's interesting because you do have Lavinia dancing, but you don't really have her meditating or doing Tai Chi.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Or writing.
Yes.
Or painting.
Or writing. Yeah, she has a little of her own character.
Yes, yes.
And I don't chew bubble gum either.
Yeah, where'd the bubble gum come from?
Yeah, how did that get in there?
I don't know where that came from. My daughter, who is in her 50s, she likes gum. She chews gum. I don't know where that came from. It just sort of came to me that she's going to chew gum. You know, I want her to chew gum.
Do they still make bubble gum? Is it still made?
That was one of the things I changed. They still make bubble gum, but when I was a kid, it was called Bazooka.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that.
Remember that?
Yep.
Well, now when I wrote about her, the new kind name was Bubblicious. And
yeah.
I didn't know that, so I had Bazooka through my novel.
Oh, so they don't have Bazooka? They don't make Bazooka bubble gum anymore?
I don't think so.
Oh wow!
So I was saying Bazooka, and the editor said, "What is Bazooka?" I said, "Well,
well, maybe."
I used to chew that when I was very young. I wonder if I could still make bubbles.
I know. We should try it.
You know what? I just Googled it, and you can certainly still buy Bazooka bubble gum in a tub.
Interesting.
Yeah, it does still have. And in fact, in April 2019, the company announced the launch of the Bazooka Throwback Pack.
Oh, I love it! Let's go. Oh, man, that was fun. Oh. It smells so good, too.
Yeah. Well,
the things you can find out in with Google.
I know.
Isn't that great?
Well, I don't like gum. I don't chew gum because I had for many, many years, I had a recurring nightmare about chewing gum where I would have this wad of gum in my mouth that kept getting bigger and bigger. And now, as a psychologist, I'm sure you can tell me what this means, but I already know.
So you already know.
I already know, yeah. The wad keeps getting bigger and bigger, and it has no flavor. And I don't want it, and I keep trying to spit it out, and the more I spit it out, the bigger it gets. So.
Oh, yuck.
Yeah, I know. So I do. If I, on the very rare occasions I chew gum, I chew it for about 10 minutes, and then I spit it out. So,
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, what's the use of chewing it once that sweetness is gone? You
right,
know?
Right, exactly, exactly.
And, I just think it's one of those habits that she was in, you know, chewing gum, drinking coffee, you know.
Well, drinking coffee, I understand, especially, I mean, the whole culture around coffee and coffee shops and the whole kind of cafe society that was in Europe and we didn't have here until the last 30 years, maybe we started developing it here. And it's so charming to me. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's a social gathering of sorts, isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can go anywhere in the world. Well, maybe not in the world, but you can go any city and you can go find these coffee shops you can go in and you can feel at home even though you don't know anybody there.
Yeah. I wonder if it's the smell.
Yes, and the ritual.
And the ritual.
Aspect of it, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't drink coffee until I was almost 40 at all. Never drank it.
Never. Wow.
We didn't grow up. We didn't. The reason was because her father and I, neither one of us drank coffee, so she didn't grow up around coffee.
I didn't, although Grandma Clements did, but
oh,
I didn't,
yeah.
But I didn't grow up around it, and I thought I didn't like it. And when I was married, and my former father-in-law, who's passed away now, but it was very traditional farm family, and anyone who comes in the house, the first thing they do is, do you want a cup of coffee? They offer a cup of coffee the moment you step your foot in the door. And for the like 20 years that I was part of that family, every time he offered me a cup of coffee, I never once said yes. You know, well, and still, every time I stepped in, he offered me a cup of coffee.
Yeah. It was kind of a social hello or something.
Yes. Yeah, it was.
Like, hello, Monica, here's your coffee.
And when I learned to drink coffee, it was about the time my daughter was she was a teenager and wanting to drink coffee. And we had a good friend who would make very sweet lattes and so forth. Mm. And that's how I got hooked on it, probably with 400 calorie lattes. Now I've matured my taste a little bit. And even though I still like cream and sugar and, you know, a sweetener in coffee, I can get by with a whole lot less and have more of the actual coffee flavor.
That's great.
So, Barbara, tell us a little bit about your path to publication.
Oh, my past one?
Your path to publication.
Oh, my path.
So you said you had written five novels, and so this is the second one that's been published. So how did you decide? Had you tried to publish the earlier ones, and how did you decide it was time to publish?
Well, the first one that I wrote, after I finished graduate school, I workshopped it at Book Passage, which is a store that we have near us that has events, or had events every day, a couple a day till the coronavirus. But I finished it, edited it, and then I sent it out to about 30 people. This was like in 1990, maybe. And I got some really sweet letters, and they said, you know, keep sending it, but we're not ready for this. So I stopped. I wrote another novel after that and another novel. And it wasn't until Anchor Out that I wrote the novel that I met Brooke Warner, who is the publisher of She Writes Press, which is called a hybrid press. Do you know about that?
I believe so, but why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about it.
Okay, so a hybrid press is you have to submit your manuscript, and they decide whether they want to publish it. But the difference about the hybrid press is that you pay some amount of money, as well as in return you receive a art director, you receive a project manager, you receive editorial services. You receive distribution. But the big difference is you have to pay up front rather than getting a advance. You get no advance. But what they do is they give you more money for each book. So traditionally, if you've gotten money, you don't really get much money for each book. But in this case, they give you like 60% of what the book costs. So I went with them, and I had a great editor, and I had a great art design cover made, and all the things that, you know, a traditional publisher would do. And then they distribute the book, and it's not self-publishing. It's the woman who started it actually was in a small, she was reading the manuscripts that came in for Seal Press, and she saw a lot of novels that were just getting, you know, they just didn't have a chance because they either weren't by people who already had some kind of a connection, or so she decided at that point to start her own business. And she did this I think it's been a good 10 years that she's been publishing women, and it's all women's work.
And the like their website says, it's founded to serve members of She Writes, the largest global community of women writers online. And so are there more other things that She Writes, you know, that community? Is it, how does it help writers?
Well, you know, what's really interesting is that you don't feel alone, because I think writing other, like, for instance, if I went with a big press, I really wouldn't be talking to other authors. But in this particular group, we help each other. Like if somebody says, oh, you know, I just got an IFPI award, and, you know, people will say, oh, that's great. And someone else will might say, you know, I'm wondering, is it a good idea to do podcasts, and how do you get that going? And then some, so we help each other. We have this like secret, what do you call those? One of a Facebook group.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then she has every 2 years, she has a meeting. It was in Arizona. And we all, a lot of us got together and we met each other and we read to each other. And we, you know, we had Jasmine Ward come as a guest speaker. And we have people from the industry come talking about different aspects of promoting your book. So she also started a university. She has an online university, Brooke Warner, and she offers a lot of opportunities for her writers. And so it's kind of like, social group in a certain way of writers, and we can talk to each other and help each other, and it's lovely for a first-time author to have that.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it's, do the authors tend to make back their investment, or some do, some don't?
No, I don't think, there's a few people who sell a lot of books, but most of us don't make back our investment. I mean, the investment is, you know, like if you're working with them for two years before your book comes out, you pay, they divide it into three amounts, and it's not exorbitant at all. And, but no, I don't think we make it back.
Mm. But
I haven't made it back. There are a few people, though, who have, because they're online all the time, and they're getting awards, and they're really working very hard to get out there, and they do really well. But most of us don't.
And Barbara, you're also working with a publicist.
Yes, I'm working with Anne Marie. And do you know Anne Marie?
I don't.
Anne Marie Nieves.
Yes, yes. And she's
yes.
with Get Read PR?
Yes, yes. Yes. Yes, I'm working with her, and she's wonderful.
And how did you connect with her?
Well, I connected with her through She Writes Press. They gave us a list of publicists, and I called a few, and I liked Anne Marie very much. So, but She Writes Press does not pay for the publicity.
I think that's pretty common these days, that, you know, authors are responsible. Even if you, it seems like even with a major press, sometimes authors have to do a lot of their own publicity also. The publishing company may do some, but
yes.
The author's got to get out there.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is a new job.
Yes. Yeah. So does it, like when you're done with one book, are you ready to go with the next one in terms of writing?
Well, yes, I'm writing. I've written a novel, and now I'm in the editing process. It's called The Time Being, The Dream Being, and it's about a fairy tale based on a Russian fairy tale called Vasilisa the Wise. And so now I'm rewriting that, and I'm also working on some memoirs. So I'm working on two things at the same time.
That must be hard.
Well, you know, one of them is done. The Dream Being is done, so I'm in the editing phase. The other one is the more creative phase, like how do I want to write a memoir, and, you know, how do I put these little stories together and find the connecting thread? Those kinds of questions are really difficult. But I've been writing these little stories about, you know, my life as a, you know, and I'm just not sure how they're going to be pulled together yet. So, Yeah, so one is done, though, but it's not. It's in its editing phase, and that takes years.
So are there times where you feel more like editing and other times you feel more like doing the creative writing? And so having both of these at the same time lets you do whatever you like best that day?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, you know, sometimes I'm really inspired. Like I'll have a little story that I want to write, and I'll write it, and then I'll just put it in my file with my, I call it Sweet Tears. That's my memoir. It's called Sweet Tears. Thank you. I put those sweet tears all together, and then I work on the dream being. Wow. Yeah.
You like to write with pen and paper, or is it pencil and paper?
I use a pen.
You use a pen. So do you have a specific ritual to that, certain type of paper, certain type of pen, anything? And how does writing by hand affect your writing?
Well, I write with a pen that has like one of those rolling ball pens, and I use a fine point. And I write in little notebooks. And I write without editing. I don't stop and write. You know, I don't write and then reread it. I just kind of write. And I write the story that way. And maybe the next day I'll look at the last line and then I'll start writing. And I really rely on my psyche to help me with the story. So that's the actual mechanism. And I use my hand because I feel that it connects me to my body in a certain way. You know, it just, it's like there's a flow of energy between my limbs and my heart and my mind. And so that's how I write. And then I do all my editing. I have to then type it in after I write it, which takes a long time, and then I start editing it.
Yeah, I can understand that connection between the hand and mind and heart. That's a ancient and natural thing, and I can see how that's good.
Mhm. Yeah, and you know, there's one thing I do, Caroline, that's really interesting that I learned from a workshop I did, and it was by a woman who was talking about healing and using your non-dominant hand. So sometimes when I don't know what the character's going to say, I pick up the pen with my non-dominant hand and I start writing. And I'll ask the question like, you know, what do you want? And then I'll take the pen with the other hand and I'll write the answer. At first, isn't that hilarious? I mean,
interesting.
It's so interesting. Like if you have a problem or something, like she did this workshop on healing and like if something's hurting you and, you know, and you'd ask the question like, how can I help you? Like your knee is hurting. How can I help you? Or, you know, so you pick up the left. I'm a right-handed person. So you pick up the left hand and the left hand might be like a child and it's able to stop walking so much or stop trying to kneel down and clean underneath that thing. You know?
See, I don't know that anyone would be able to read what I wrote with my left hand.
No, but you can't read it. You can't read it.
Well, Barbara, it's been lovely talking to you today, and we're out of time.
Unfortunately, we're out of time.
We're out of time. And we've been talking about The Laundress by Barbara Sapienza. And, Mom, do you have some closing words?
Yeah, I do. You know, in this story, this young woman finds herself in a difficult situation, but she has friends. And sometimes the only way to endure one of life's difficult situations is to remember that reaching out in kindness helps to heal many wounds. Aww. And we all know that's true.
Mm-hmm. And that's definitely a good thing to remember to now in this time.
Yeah.
So thank you, Barbara.
You're welcome. Thank you. And thank everybody for allowing this to happen. It's a beautiful thing for me.
Oh, you're very welcome. And bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
See you all next week on Writer's Voices.